the environment we put kids in is a much bigger predictor of what's going to happen to them than the instincts. But if we understand these instincts and the role that they play and set out to nurture them early on, I think we avoid a lot of the adversity that happens.
This is Enriching Education, the show for educators and evaluators who are striving to enrich the lives of each unique student. Brought to you by Riverside Insights. How we look at development and intelligence has evolved as we learn more about the brain. Dr. Sam Goldstein has a revolutionary perspective on this that encompasses critical thinking, creativity, and what he has deemed the seven human instincts. Dr. Goldstein is a neuropsychologist, author, test developer, and educator who specializes in the intricate tapestry of child development. In this episode, he speaks with Dr. Tammy Stevens about shifting the educational focus from a child's weaknesses to their inherent strengths and competencies, as well as the concept of tenacity as an essential framework to understand and nurture children, especially in the face of adversity. Dr. Goldstein challenges the status quo and lays the groundwork for a much-needed educational renaissance.
All right, welcome. Good morning, Dr. Goldstein. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. It's an honor to have you here today and privileged to be speaking to you. We're really excited to have you on this episode of Enriching Education. You have really dedicated your life to helping children and also the parents. And when I Google you and I gain information about you, I know that you're a psychologist, you're a neuropsychologist, you're an author, test developer, an educator, not to mention you're a screenwriter and a musician. Yes. So really excited to have you here today. And I know we're not going to talk much about your screenwriting or your acting or your musician pieces, but we're really going to focus in today on talking about the work that you do, the great work that you do with children and with parents. So I know a lot of your research over the years has been in the areas of autism. I know you've done a lot with ADHD, executive functioning, resiliency. That's something that's near and dear to my heart. And I really love reading the information that you have out there, your books on resiliency. But I know that you recently published a book entitled Tenacity in Children. So that's really what I'd like to talk to you today about. I know in your current practice, when you're conducting assessments and you're meeting with parents, et cetera, and you're making those recommendations for what parents should be doing to help their children, et cetera, I understand that you like to look at parenting and teaching through the lens of nurturing what's in children instead of fixating on what's wrong. I love that view. But I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about that and tell me the impact of that that's had in the field.
Sure. Just as a bit of foundation, I started out to be a brain researcher. And through the course of my career, as with all of us, we have certain moments of epiphany where an idea comes into our head and we realize, oh, maybe we should do things differently or look at things differently. And the first one I had was over 45 years ago when I finally decided I liked people better than rats. And the second one was when I decided I liked kids better than adults, not in terms of socializing, but in terms of my clinical work. That was one. And when I made the shift from more harder science to applied clinical practice, 45 years ago, there were no neuropsychology programs. Clinical psychology was still relatively in its infancy. And I shifted into a school psychology program because they seemed to do and offer what I was interested in, assessing a child's development and designing intervention. Whether it's in the schools or not didn't matter to me. And so I set out taking coursework. And what you immediately realize is that you spend a lot of time learning about what's wrong, right? The psychopathology of childhood, the learning disabilities, the emotional disorders. And it's fairly rare that you take a class in what's right. And after finishing my doctorate and opening a clinic, we're in our 43rd year here. A neurologist and I opened this clinic. We see about 800 children a year. You don't want your children to see me because we see brain injuries and genetic disorders. I've done a couple of TED Talks that people can look at about our clinic. And I began realizing that I was focusing on what was wrong under the assumption that by setting out to fix what was wrong, somehow I could improve the present and future quality of a child's life. But over a period of time, it became apparent that wasn't working. Children who had struggles, whether it's a diagnosis, ADHD or autism or anxiety or depression or learning disability, that we treated their symptoms, but they never really seemed to do better, not in terms of symptom relief, because symptom relief doesn't equate with changing long-term outcome. We know that. And about 8 years or so into my practice, I had another epiphany. And it occurred to me that what was right about people was much more important than what was wrong with them in terms of trying to chart a course for them to manage their adversities and to take advantage of their assets. And I began working with Bob Brooks, who was at Harvard at the time in McLean Hospital. The Tenacity book you mentioned is the 15th book we've done together.
Wow.
And it's still the case that I do about 200 evaluations a year still in the clinic here. And it's still the case that my first question to parents is, what do you like about your child? What's right about your child? What are you not worried about your child? Because in the end, what we've demonstrated is that children who have adversities growing up, who as adults manage those adversities and find some happiness and success in life, do so not because of treatment. I'm not against treatment, but do so because they have other strengths and other assets that they have opportunities to take advantage of. And hence, what's right about you is much more than what's wrong with you. And Bob and I coined a term, islands of competence. And our saying is that if you have an ocean of inadequacy, you better have an island of competence, someplace where you feel okay as a person and feel connected, feel competent, feel capable, feel safe, whatever the case may be. And that's really what's going to get you through. And so this ordinary magic, as Ann Mastin has coined the term, these ordinary qualities that most children have an opportunity to access, children who struggle have fewer opportunities to access these ordinary qualities. And I'll finish by saying, Bob and I, the first book we wrote was Raising Resilient Children, and it was a trade book. Now we've got three major textbooks that we've edited on this, looking at the science, the research of it. But I will tell you that 25 years ago, when we published that book, and it's still my best-selling book, it's in its 30th printing, because it seems to resonate with people. But the publisher didn't want us to use the word resilience, because it's a material science term. It means stretching and returning back to your original position. And people weren't using it psychologically. Maybe a few, Emmy Werner, Michael Rutter, there were some people using it in a research context, looking at why some children survived or thrived in adversity. But it's become very popular. President Bush stood on the ruins of the World Trade Towers after 9/11 and used that word.
Resilient.
And from then on, if you do one of those searches, you know, there's resilience, everything's resilience. Estee Lauder has a makeup called resilience. and people don't understand that resilience is not recovery. It's functioning well over time.
Right.
And again, it's not a magical set of qualities that neurotypical or normally developing children present that children with disabilities don't. It's more access to opportunity. If you struggle with academics at school, if you struggle to socialize, to manage your emotions, to control your impulses, then the everyday small successes that build on each other to define who you see yourself as a person are few and far between.
Mm. Yeah.
The word self-esteem, you and I are well aware because we've known each other. I don't want to date your age.
Please don't.
I'll just say we've known each other a very, very long time.
Yeah.
And I've always been a big fan of your approach as an educational consultant and as an educator, that children need that day in and day out affirmation of who they are and how they feel and what they can do. And children with challenges don't have that. So the last thing I'll say, I'm talking a lot here, but okay. The last thing I'll say is, remember when we first started with IEPs, we first started with a discussion of what are your child's strengths? What are the student's strengths? Then we talked about liabilities.
Absolutely.
And somehow that's gone away.
I totally agree.
And we rarely, if ever, talk about strengths. And when I try to sit in on an IEP meeting, which I do now because we can do it through Zoom, and I ask, could we start with the strengths? Many teachers respond with, well, why? We don't need to put them on the IEP. The child doesn't need any help with those. And my response is, no, the child needs more opportunities to display their islands of competence to create a balance in their perception of who am I.
I love that. And I so agree with that. I think that so often we're so focused on what is wrong or what's negative, what those weaknesses are, and we forget about those areas of strengths. And I'll bet parents really appreciate that too, because I'm sure over the years, all they've heard is, this is what's wrong, this is what's wrong. Finally, someone wants me to tell them what's right about my child. I love that.
Right.
So you mentioned resiliency. And with your new book, you're talking about the title Tenacity in Children. First of all, could you define what tenacity means? And how is tenacity different, or is it, than resilience?
Sure. And for the listeners who are unaware, tenacity is our 15th book. In fact, the book we're halfway through now is titled Rivalry, a Jealousy and Competition, Harnessing Your Basic Instincts for Life Success.
Wow.
Because it's our position that those qualities arose in our species because they had some protective or evolutionary advantage. And we've kind of vilified them. Don't be jealous. Don't be rivalrous. Don't compete. And in fact, that's not right, I think.
Yeah.
But putting that aside, so there are a bunch of books in between, trade books, between resilience and tenacity. And we did a book on for adults on the power of resilience, always trying to apply what we know from research science to clinical practice. We applied this resilience model in our books for parents of children with autism or children with self-discipline problems. And along the way, if we define resilience as the ability to continue functioning under duress, again, it's not recovery. It's functioning okay over time, right? And people, again, as I mentioned, don't completely get that. So we looked at what qualities help any of us under stress or adversity function, right? Having a person that you know cares about you, having an island of competence, learning how to problem solve, developing empathy. All of these, again, we refer to as typical human qualities that help us in the course of our everyday lives, right? And the world has become even more stressful when we look at mental health problems among kids. Before COVID, maybe 1 out of 5 to 1 out of 4 teens had a major depressive episode sometime during their teenage years. Now the data argues it's 1 out of 2. Some of that can be skewed by telehealth because prior to COVID, insurance carriers wouldn't allow telehealth.
Gotcha.
Now telehealth is here to stay. So access to mental health services is literally a click away. And I don't think anybody's really examined it, but it's clear there are far more mental health visits today for adolescents than ever before. That may not just be because there's more need. It may also be because access is easier. Okay. So now we come to this idea of tenacity. And let me be completely honest, okay? In the 25 years since Raising Resilient Children have come out, we couldn't trademark the word resilience. In the beginning, it was like, oh, resilience. Everybody now uses the term. There's a lot of misunderstanding about, I think, what does it really mean? And believe it or not, other authors have taken our exact titles and put them into their books. There is a book called The Power of Resilience. There are a number of books with resilience in the title. And we all sit by fires others have made or walk paths others have forged, as it were. And it's always nice when someone like Angela Duckworth or people who've written about their own idea, emotional intelligence or grit or whatever, says, oh, these guys, Goldstein and Brooks, this is what they talked about. A lot of times they pretend they invented it and there's nothing I can do about it. So I will tell you honestly, I went to Bob and I said, we need to focus more on human instincts. That qualities of empathy, fairness, problem solving, these are baked into our genes. And that started us on this search for what are those instincts? And the idea of an instinct, not like a bird building a nest or a salmon swimming upstream, but an instinct that displays itself when opportunity arises. And our approach for parents is that you don't dictate these things. You don't have to even teach these things. You have to create opportunities for parents to give kids a chance to have these things just naturally come out. And they do. Two-year-olds want to help cook and clean and drive the car. And right, it just comes out if you create opportunities. And we found 7 instincts that we thought really defined who we are as humans. And other species have some of it, but language enables us to have more of it. And 3 instincts that we thought were good for survival 100,000 years ago, but not so good today. And we could talk briefly about those. Yeah. We call them the unholy trinity.
Okay.
And then we thought, what are we going to call this book? And here's how I did it. I said, we're going to find a word that there's no other title of a book for.
Nice. Okay.
Because if people are going to rip it off, then let's start with a new title and let them rip that one off. So we went searching. And we had a number of candidates. There had to be some relationship because tenacity is the ability to keep pushing, keep moving forward. But in and of itself, tenacity is not an instinct. It's a description of behavior.
Okay.
Right? It's not even an outcome. It's similar to resilience. I guess I would argue that resilience encompasses a broad range of behaviors that let you function adequately under stress or under duress. And tenacity is one aspect of that, meaning it's the continuing to push forward.
So kind of like the persistence, having that persistence to
right.
push forward.
And if people are interested, on my website, which is just samgoldstein.com, there's a number of free webinars where we go through this and define it and explain it. But tenacity in and of itself, again, is a term we coined and then said, guess what? Tenacity is the umbrella under which we're going to put these instincts.
Okay.
There was a bit of a, I don't know if selfish is the right word to use.
Motivated you a bit.
There was a bit of a plan of let's pick a title. It's no different than some of the other writers who've picked terms like emotional intelligence mm-hmm. or grit. You want to find a title that you're not competing with 10 other titles.
Right.
And nowadays, if you put the word resilience into a title of a book, you're competing with all kinds of books. And with tenacity, I think there's a novel with that term, but we didn't find anything else. So my hope is that when someone says tenacity in children, they go, oh, that's Goldstein and Brooks' idea that children have instincts. And our job as parents and educators is to create opportunities for those instincts to be nurtured.
Nice. I love it. So you talked about the 7, or you mentioned the 7 different instincts. Can you talk to us a little bit about each of those?
We'll cover each one very briefly.
Yes.
And then there's one I want to spend a little more time on.
Okay.
Because I think it eventually will create a revolution in education. Because you and I are well aware, because we've advocated together for years, that the educational system is based on 19th century ideas. And I'm a bit of a cynic because I think for the most part in the 1800s, public schools were created and mandated to keep children out of the workforce. It wasn't because they felt, oh, kids have to go to school to be educated. It was a 9-year-old works a lot cheaper than an adult. So we're going to push them out of the competition. And in some ways, we're still using the educational system to keep kids out of the workforce.
Mm.
This last one, I think there's a need to change for us to look at as a foundation for change.
Sure.
But let me go through them. And let me also tell you that we've picked a descriptor for each one, a modifier for each one. Again, why? So it's identified with us. Because if I say one of the instincts is optimism, people talk about optimism all the time. But if I say one of the instincts is intuitive optimism, and I say intuitive means you just see it, you know it, right? Now that term is associated, we're the ones who use that term. So intuitive optimism means you almost instinctually, in terms of an instinct, go into things believing you can do it. 2 and 3-year-olds think they can do everything, right? So that's intuitive optimism. Then intrinsic motivation. So again, motivation, it could be inside, could be from the outside. In our parenting and education, we start with the inside, but as soon as a student has any problems or a child has any behavioral difficulty, we quickly shift to the extrinsic. I'll give you this, you can have this, you can't have that. Intrinsic motivation means I'm going to focus on ways for you to motivate yourself inside. So secondary reinforcers like food or prizes or whatever. We don't need that. The payoff for doing it is how you feel about it. So that's the second. The third one is compassionate empathy. Everybody understands empathy, walking in somebody else's shoes. And here, compassion means you not only walk in their shoes, but you really make an effort to appreciate what it's like for them. And in the book, we start each chapter by going through the research. Again, not research as in COVID research, because who knows what that is, but just simple studies of children behaving in certain ways in the presence of certain opportunities. And there's a lot of interesting research. Fourth one is altruism, which means what? Giving of yourself to help others. And we put the modifier genuine in front of it because you're not doing it for any other reason other than this is what you want to do. There's no return for you. There's no payoff. There's nothing. Then responsibility. And nowadays, no one takes responsibility anymore for anything. So why should kids? And we pick the word virtuous, which means you're doing it for the right reason.
Right.
The sixth one is fairness. Why is fairness so important in our species? From our kids, it's not fair. It's not fair.
Right.
It's not fair.
Right.
To my three dogs. So, you know, I sit the three dogs down and I give two of them a chewing treat. And the third one gets a treat. He likes it, but not the favorite one. And the other two run off with their treats. And the third one sits there and looks down at it and looks at me like,
that's not fair.
I'm not buying this, right? So even dogs think about fairness. Okay. If you go back 10,000 years, we were all generalists. Everybody did everything. And suddenly it became apparent that, oh, somebody's a better hunter than others. Someone is better at making moccasins. Someone starts fires better, whatever. And all of a sudden there were specialties. And if you could do something other people couldn't do, there was some bonus in it for you, some extra payoff. And we see that today in the arts, in the sports and entertainment. Do they really make a contribution to our welfare? Yeah, they entertain us. They make us feel better. But is an athlete, should they really be paid $1 million for 2 hours of work?
Right.
Granted, they work hard, there's preparation, but why isn't a teacher paid $2 million? Because somewhere in that teacher's classroom is a child who may change the world, right? I tell teachers, I want you to assume in your classroom is a child who may change the world, but you don't know which child it is. So you better treat every child as a child who might change the world. Okay, so that's the six. The last one we refer to as simultaneous intelligence. And the word simultaneous comes from the Russian neuropsychologist Luria. So I didn't coin the term simultaneous. Intelligence is a much debated phenomenon. And up until recently, you and I would tell people, intelligence is set in stone.
Exactly.
It is what it is. That's it. Okay. Simultaneous means seeing how all the pieces fit together. And the way the schools have defined intelligence now, you can't enter a gifted program if you're not advanced in reading and math. Mm-hmm. And from an empirical perspective, can we prove that great inventors, great leaders, great scientists, great politicians, whatever the case may be, that greatness has much of a correlation with their ability to read, spell, write, or do math. And it has some correlation, but it's not 100%, right? So the word we use is simultaneous. It means seeing how all the pieces fit together at the same time. So if I say to you, 4, 6, 8, 10. You only need to know 10 to predict 12. Sequence.
Right.
If I say 1, 3, 6, 10, 15. 1, 3, 6, 10, 15. To know the next number is 21, you have to simultaneously appreciate the gap between each set of numbers keeps increasing by 1. If I remove a number from that pattern, you can't figure it out.
Right.
If I give you 10 facts about an animal, and you pick 3, you might choose an animal that matches the 3, doesn't match the remaining 7. So good critical thinkers use all the information at their disposal in an effort to solve problems. This is really what intelligence is, and I think it arose in our species based on our ability to see patterns in the environment. 50,000 years ago, you look over the savanna, where's safety? Where's water? Where's danger? Jack Naglieri and I and J.P. Das have a test called the cognitive assessment system that measures patterns. And Aboriginal children in the outback and affluent children in suburbia perform the same way at the same age because And knowing the days of the week or the months of the year is a consequence of opportunity and memory, not an example of your ability to think critically. And in this framework, then, creativity is taking a piece of information from out here that other people don't have and putting it in the box with all the information you and everybody else has, which lets you come up with something new or novel.
Right.
This is what intelligence really is. And when you teach children how to do this, which really involves them figuring it out and you guiding them, their grades go up. And I'm not just making that up. There's good studies to show their grades go up. Their ability to solve social problems goes up. Everything improves.
Mm-hmm.
So teachers now talk about executive functions, which is what? Strategies. Anything you do, from control your emotions, to be organized, to get started, to have a plan, to pay attention to detail. Anything you do that improves outcome, we put under that umbrella of executive functioning, right?
Right.
And if outcome is better, your thinking is better. And so you see the shift now where 10 or 15 years ago, if I used the word executive functioning with a teacher, they would look at me cross-eyed. And now, oh, executive functioning.
Right.
And you know, you're aware that Jack and I have a screener that's used by psychologists and in schools that looks at executive functioning. Mm-hmm. That and the other one, the brief that's been around even longer. But it's routine now to ask, what's this child's executive functioning like? And appreciating that no matter what the problem is, enhancing executive functioning, teaching critical thinking leads to better outcome.
Absolutely.
Right. So there's the foundation for the seven instincts. We can talk about the unholy trinity if you'd like as well.
Yeah, I just want to make one comment. Like when you're talking about intelligence and we have this traditional understanding of, you know, what it is. And I think sometimes in the past, like to your point, is we don't really look at some of those other strengths that an individual has. And for instance, my grandfather, Pap, he never went to school. He's illiterate, couldn't read or write, but that man could play any instrument by ear. He couldn't read music, but just by ear, I mean, he played the banjo, he'd play the guitar, he'd play the fiddle, mandolin, right, the harmonica, everything, every piece of instrument he could play. And the other thing I think about too with him is he was so talented in, he did a lot of that work that they did on the ceilings. Can't remember the name of it right now. Plastering, like elaborate designs and things like that. And that's all things that he learned kind of on the job type stuff.
Correct.
But you can't tell me I could go give him an intelligence test and I bet he wouldn't have scored very high, but you can't tell me that he wasn't intelligent. He had his own strengths.
And that, again, definition drives a lot of things. I can call you careful. Someone else can call you slow.
Exactly.
And I'm a big stickler. I think I've advocated that when we go to educational meetings with parents, that the first thing we give them is a glossary of terms. When we use this word, this is what we mean.
Mm-hmm.
Because even intelligence, I'm more of a purist. For me, intelligence is about critical thinking. It's about how you solve problems,
yep,
whether it's artistic problems or musical problems or
mechanical.
So I'm not a fan of, I'm not a fan of, quote, multiple intelligence, because I think the underlying driver of all of those is a singular phenomenon.
Right.
Your ability to analyze data and see relationships between pieces of information and solve problems.
Mm-hmm.
But as you're well aware, there's this kind of intelligence and that kind of intelligence. And again, I think what's being described is the medium, as with your grandfather, in which the person is working.
Right.
But I don't think saying you have emotional intelligence really explains the underlying phenomena of your ability to use critical thinking in circumstances that involve emotions. I think it's the same thing. But I also don't think we're Stepford Wives or in the Matrix.
Right.
So just because someone is a good critical thinker when it comes to physics or mathematics doesn't necessarily mean they're going to be a good critical thinker when it comes to emotions.
Social situations, yes.
Right. And I don't choose to explain that discrepancy by saying, oh, see, that proves there's different kinds of intelligence. I choose to explain that discrepancy by saying that the underlying ability is applied more efficiently in some circumstances by some brains than in other circumstances. I tend to not be as a strong of an advocate for the social brain and
emotional
the emotional brain.
Mm-hmm.
There's few of us who can apply our critical thinking abilities in every area. Mm-hmm. But the fact that you can apply it in one area doesn't mean you're deficient in a kind of intelligence.
Right.
So it's the same thing with when I talk to parents about trying to discern. I did this yesterday with a parent of a five-year-old who's been delayed in developing language, trying to discern, is this a language problem or is this a critical thinking problem? So what we did is we looked at the testing. I'd given this kid parts of the Brigance,
okay,
but I also had given this kid the WPSI.
Mm-hmm.
And we looked at block design and puzzles, which is a form of problem solving. Doesn't really require any words, just recognition of the images in the puzzles. And the child was average.
Mm.
And then we looked at information, similarities, comprehension, and the child was way below average. And what I explained to the parent is that the problem is the medium, not the ability. Your child can think critically, but the part of the brain that employs language to do it is immature. It's taking longer to develop. So for me, that's not a critical thinking problem. That's a language problem, as opposed to another child who, no matter what medium I try and use, their ability to apply critical thinking is impaired.
Absolutely.
And that's really global delay,
yes,
right? So that's how I try and say to parents, here are the foundations, and you're aware, I follow Luria's model, mm-hmm, with that the brain does four basic things: simultaneous or critical thinking, attention to detail, sequencing, and that those four really comprise how we go about interacting with the world.
I love that. I love that description. So what are those holy trinities that you mentioned?
Oh, the unholy trinity.
Unholy trinities.
Unholy. The holy is the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Unholy.
What's the unholy trinity? Okay. So imagine it's 100,000 years ago, and we don't know anything about the environment, and the sun goes down. You have to have a certain belief that it's going to come up the next day, or we can't find food. You have to have a certain belief that if we keep looking, we'll find it. So belief kept us alive. Now look at belief taken to excess today in our species. How does adverse belief or confrontational belief, how is it impacting politics, relations between people, countries? Belief's a valuable ally in the absence of fact, which is what our ancestors needed.
Yep.
But when fact is there, adverse belief, when it's maintained in the presence of fact that would argue against it, causes problems. So belief is one, gets us into trouble. Second one is sometimes what I call brain dancing, meaning we can get upset very easily over trivial things and strike out aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
So again, it's 50,000 years ago, you have food and won't share it with me. So I hit you over the head with a stick and I take your food. There's no police. I survive. You do not. Which is why we are such a violent, aggressive species. I'm not making excuses for it.
Right.
But it enhanced survival. But today, does it enhance survival? No. It creates the idea of conflict over any other kind of resolution, physically aggressive conflict. Look at the world.
That's what I was going to say. Aren't you seeing?
Right.
It's almost like we're transitioning back to the way things were.
Yeah, I don't know that we're regressing. I just think the world's a whole lot more complicated. And therefore, it pushes those limits. We brain dance quicker. So belief, an aggressive response to even minor provocation. And the third one is a fear of difference.
Mm.
Because 50,000 years ago, you didn't go over to the tribe on the other side of the valley for a social call because they would kill you and eat you.
Mm-hmm.
And look at how fear of difference affects us today.
Absolutely.
And this is a bit controversial of me to say, because some of that fear of difference is certainly driven by what children learn and observe.
Right.
But we know that there is a genetics to it as well. And I don't want to misspeak, that our nervous system reacts a little adversely when we're confronted with someone who's different, without even being told about it. And then it can be reinforced. I don't see the society as causing the problem. I see the society as reinforcing that fear of difference, which could have been managed easily when children are young, but then it gets reinforced of, you know, that difference is bad. You're the wrong color skin. You're the wrong religion. You live in the wrong place. And that makes you less than me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the idea that you're the cognitive component that goes with it, you're less than me. That's learned.
Yeah.
But the little bit of arousal that your nervous system has when you're confronted with somebody who's different, that's baked into our genes. And so it's those three: belief, fear of difference, aggressive response. Look at the world today and tell me that those three don't play a significant
Absolutely.
Role.
Absolutely.
But the solution is use the seven instincts. Start early, reinforce the opportunity to develop the seven instincts. You won't have to worry about the other three.
So does the fear of difference, is that where some of that implicit bias comes into play?
Right. And again, my view of it is that as a society and a culture, we reinforce that. But I'm not convinced that we cause it. I'm not convinced that if we went back to Walden 2 and Skinner put all the kids in a box and et cetera, that they'd all get along well. That the first time a child who looks one way is confronted by a child who looks the other way, there's going to be a little bit of dissonance. Mm-hmm. It's just baked into our genes. But what we do with that difference is the same as what we're saying with autism. If I can find your potential for social learning problems very early, I avoid you developing all kinds of adverse behaviors. And in a theory of emergent functioning in genetics, I begin exposing you to more and more social activities, which then affects you. And these kids do better. If you look at Early Start Denver or CERTS or some of the early programs, they work.
Right.
So in the end, the environment we put kids in is a much bigger predictor of what's going to happen to them than the instincts. But if we understand these instincts and the role that they play and set out to nurture them early on, I think we avoid a lot of the adversity that happens.
So that brings me to a question. I was reading your book here and you were talking about the intuitive optimism. And that really stood out to me. Thinking, you know, you're born believing, right? So I love that example that you had. Andy wanted to, he wanted his six-year-old, right? He wanted his dad to buy the neighbor's car because he wanted to fix this car up and make it a race car. And you guys ask him, hey, Andy, have you ever fixed a car? And he's like, you know, with a smile and with his intuitive optimism, he said, no, but my dad can teach me and I can do it. I love that because it's so true, right? But given what you're saying too, at what point, because you were talking about how important the environment is. Yes, we're born with this, but if this Andy grew up in an environment where dad was like, you can't do this, or you can't, you know, the negativity and stuff, at what point does that squash Andy's intuitive optimism?
The late Emmy Werner, who we consider sort of the godmother of research in resilience, has said that experience trumps genetics and biologically driven qualities in all but the most extreme cases. In genetics, we have a theory of emergent function, meaning that the genes are there, but they require an experiential push from the environment. And again, arguing that these are instincts argues that they're not evenly distributed in the population. Some kids just are much more optimistic than others. They're just born that way, right? Or they develop that way. But everyone has that. And so now, as what I said a minute ago, that you could have all the genes to be intuitively optimistic. You could have all the genes to speak. You could have all the genes to deal with situations in a fair way. But if I don't give you the opportunity to express those genes experientially, they don't develop. So at what age does it make a difference? I don't know that anybody really knows. If you start telling a two-year-old, you're not going to do that, you're stupid, you can't be interesting. I mean, we don't do those kinds of experiments.
No, we don't, thank goodness.
Right. But look at animals. If you raise a canine in an adverse environment where you're always yelling at it, critical of it, what kind of an animal is it? It's a fearful, anxious animal that lacks any sense of what am I supposed to be doing here? What do I do here?
Yes.
Why do I do it? One of the projects I'm trying to start, you and I should do more of it, is where will our schools be in 50 years? Because we can't keep doing what we're doing. My cell phone can answer any question. And now with chat, you know, I can even make up things. But I don't need years and years of someone hammering factual information into my head that I have to retrieve. And those who retrieve it better get higher scores, even if they're not better thinkers or better problem solvers. I'd like to see schools where we don't start teaching reading and math until kids are in third grade.
We were talking about this on a previous podcast episode. We were talking about, you know, school readiness. And what our guest, she had worked in education. She was a kindergarten teacher back in the 70s. She was one of the first special ed teachers here in Texas. And she was telling us that what is considered an expected skills for kids coming into kinder now were skills that she was teaching in kinder. So we have set higher expectations that a lot of times don't align to their developmental.
But most of those expectations have to do with acquired knowledge.
Yes, true.
Right? Not necessarily critical thinking. And in the couple of studies where they haven't started teaching reading until kids are into school for a couple of grades, within a very short period of time, they catch up. Now, that being said, there's going to be 1 out of 5 kids, just on a bell curve basis, for whom more practice to build proficiency in reading is going to be required. Your handicap relative to the people around you, right? Why is this kid have a reading disorder? Well, he's not learning to read as fast as we think he should or as fast as the other kids. Well, what if all the kids learn to read that way? We'd say that's normal.
Right.
So we still need to identify those who need more time to acquire academic knowledge. And you and I are well aware, we use an instrument like the Patel or a quick screening like children's ability to repeat sentences back, longer strings of sentences, very predictive of those kids who are going to have sequential problems learning to read. I'm not arguing that we don't identify those in need early and provide more time at the front end as opposed to the back end.
Right.
But we need to spend more time teaching thinking.
Absolutely.
Giving kids the opportunity to figure that out.
It does concern me that a lot of our kids, I say a lot, I don't have any statistic to support this, but this is just from what I experienced. They don't have those critical thinking skills. Now that we have internet and all this, I'm all for it, but it's like they'll read it and believe it. It goes back to that unholy trinity. They'll read it, believe it without having the facts to support it. And that's scary.
Right. And again, I think we can teach people to be better consumers of information.
Absolutely.
And better able to evaluate the veracity of that information. But we're not going to get away from the fact that we're a species whose survival, other hominid species are gone, we're the only one left, mm-hmm. is based on the fact that we had belief, is based on the fact that we did brain dance, mm-hmm. is based on the fact that we are afraid of difference. All of these, quote, terrible qualities, they got us here. Mm. But no one's ever stopped to ask, in a complex, organized society, maybe those qualities become the greater liabilities than benefits. Mm. It's a tough question to ask, but is it possible that certain ways of behaving and feeling and thinking at one point in time are adaptive, but at another point in time are not?
Right.
We don't really examine that. One of the things that would be great for Riverside to do is once a year bring thinkers together and maybe just free associate.
Mm-hmm.
What are we doing? Where are we going? We don't spend any time talking about where is education in the next 50 years? And I think we have to turn schools inside out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think we have to make a lot of changes. But when was the last time you had a conversation with someone about how are we going to get from where we are today to schools that are really going to prepare kids for the future? And even now with COVID, what are we measuring? What are we talking about? Maybe this is my parting shot. What are we talking about? Oh, they fell behind in math. They fell behind in reading. Nobody ever says, oh, they fell behind in their progress of critical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
They don't think or problem solve as well as they otherwise would have had we continued to send them to school. I'm not saying that's true.
Right.
But nobody talks about mm-hmm. it. All they're talking about is, oh, look, they didn't reach the benchmark for math. I don't care. You could have a society full of people who are good thinkers, none of whom can read very well. That society is going to work very well.
Right.
And you could have a society of people who read well and don't know how to think. And that society is going to fall apart.
So what recommendations do you have for parents and for teachers for teaching those critical thinking skills?
Take advantage of the resources that are available.
Mm-hmm.
My reports used to contain pages of resources and recommendations. Mm-hmm. Now they don't, because parents can go to the web. They don't need me to regurgitate. And I'll direct them to sites. There's a whole host of websites that teach kids critical thinking. You Google critical thinking and you get sites from the Fed, from LDA, from Gifted. There's all kinds of sites that teach how to teach critical thinking and problem solving at any age. I think every student should have a business plan or an educational plan that starts with their strengths. Mm-hmm. And the more liabilities they have, the more we've got to search for their strengths. I'll leave you with this as our time is running out. I send parents home for some kids and ask them to divide a piece of paper in half. And on the left side, put down everything that worries them about their kid. Mm-hmm. And on the right side, put down everything that reassures them or every strength that leads them to believe someday their kid will do fine. And I tell them, you can't stop until you have twice as many on the positive side as on the negative side.
Nice.
Because we've taken to believing that fixing is a way of equaling the playing field for kids.
Mm-hmm.
And you and I know not true. And it's not because the lay person, the average parent or teacher, is uneducated or doesn't have a good heart. It's they're just misinformed. Mm-hmm. We need to do a better job of informing them.
Absolutely.
Thanks for having
me. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really enjoyed our conversation. And yeah, count me in on looking at the schools over the next 50 years. I'd love to do something with you.
You know, I think at our national conferences that you and I have attended so much, but now people don't attend as much anymore, there should be opportunities for thought leaders to just sit and talk. Mm-hmm. I mean, look at what they do in business, Davos,
yes,
right? And what are they doing there? Just brainstorming. Why don't we do that when it comes to education?
Absolutely. We should change that. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Thank you for listening to Enriching Education, brought to you by Riverside Insights. For more on how you can enrich the lives of students, visit us at riversideinsights.com.